This is the World Vision Report. I'm Lita Hartman. Here's a holiday riddle for you. What's 362 feet tall, built by Brazilians, and strung with 44 miles of lights? It's the world's largest Christmas tree on display in Mexico City.
Graças a Deus, coloquei a estrela no lugar.
Thanks be to God, I put the star in place on December 4th at 5 p.m. Seeing the Mexican people so happy makes me feel like we've achieved something.
In Rwanda, a reporter starts out writing about the genocide and ends up with a daughter. And a day in the life of the Titanic. That's not the ship. It's a government building in Liberia with hundreds of squatters.
It was just a vacant place. We decided to come and live here. We just live in peace.
Around the world with the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Lita Hartman, in for Peggy Wehmeyer. We keep hearing that the worst of the financial crisis is over and things are slowly turning around. But aid organizations are still feeling the pinch. As a result, many projects in the developing world have had to shut down or cut back. One of those projects is in Lebanon. Much of Lebanon is literally a minefield. The country is littered with landmines and other bombs from recent conflicts there. Aid workers had hoped the country could be made mine-free by the end of this year, but the global recession has put the brakes on that. Don Duncan reports.
When Salima Barakat walks through her olive grove in South Lebanon, she does so with a limp. That and the scars on her body tell the story of one of the millions of cluster bombs dropped by Israel during its 2006 war with Hezbollah. It landed in Salima's kitchen, exploded, and left shrapnel lodged in various parts of her body.
It tore my intestines open. My fingers were hurt, and some hit my head. Some fragments came through the sole of my foot up to the upper foot, and it still hurts.
Salima's olive grove also sustained heavy damage. Many of her olive trees were uprooted.
I used to make a lot of profit from the olives, but I had to stop. I depend completely on that grove for my living.
Lebanon is not only riddled with cluster bombs, but also landmines. These explosives date back to Lebanon's civil war and the many occupations and conflicts that followed. The 2006 war added just another layer, especially in southern Lebanon. Much of the farmland here is now too dangerous to use, so agricultural output has dropped by 25% in the past 3 years. And yet, out of desperation, many farmers still venture into their contaminated land to harvest. Many of them have paid a price, losing limbs or lives. Around this part of Lebanon, this is what hope sounds like. On the windy hills around Salima's house, several demining teams are hard at work trying to make the land safe again. From afar, they look like clusters of beetles, their visors and protective jackets shimmering occasionally under the hot Lebanese sun. Up close, you can see the metal detectors they use to scour the soil for explosives. Once they locate a mine or cluster bomb, they carefully dig it out and defuse the explosive. The work is slow and dangerous. The teams are made up mostly of local Lebanese who have been trained by various international demining organizations. Hamid Dohman is the demining site supervisor here. He says clearing an explosive can take hours, but the work's results are apparent immediately. Often local farmers can be found waiting by the minefield's edge as the demining team works.
You can see all the locals now planting their land. You can see everybody is happy because you can see everybody is working his land here in this village. The people here are not afraid to plow their land.
It's estimated that some 1.5 million unexploded ordnances are still scattered across Lebanese territory. There was hope that all of those could be cleared by the end of next year, but that was before the global recession hit.
Many donors, they're unable to support mine action in southern Lebanon. So this has reduced the number of teams significantly.
Christina Benica works for the Mine Advisory Group, or MAG. I met up with her by the sea in the city of Tyre. MAG is one of the few demining organizations still working in Lebanon. Most of the others have had to pull out because of evaporating funds. But MAG is one of the biggest and is still managing to squeeze some money out of its traditional donors, Western governments and the United Nations. The financial crisis has meant that the total number of demining teams in Lebanon has been cut from about 120 to around 40.
What our donors need to realize is that mine action is almost like building the foundation of a house. You cannot implement a construction project, you cannot build schools, you cannot start a water sanitation project without mine clearance.
Now that the pace of demining has slowed down, she says that Lebanon won't be explosive-free for 5 years, maybe longer. Salima Barakat's olive grove was fully cleared of explosives last year. Although it's still not returned to its former yield, Salima is thankful.
With each passing day, I can see my land coming more and more back to life. Even though my living conditions have not improved so much since the war, this is the one sign of hope I have.
In the meantime, Lebanon's dwindling army of deminers will continue their painstaking task, one landmine at a time. Dawn Duncan, World Vision Report, Nabatea, Lebanon.
It can be easy for kids who grow up around gangs to just fall into that way of life. Often it's because there are no real alternatives. Reporter Lisa Morehouse met one San Francisco teenager who's found an escape route from her rough neighborhood, and now she has sweet dreams, literally, for her future. Here's her story.
17-year-old Ruby Ruiz hops onto the number 23 bus to get from her neighborhood to San Francisco's Mission District.
Well, now we're going to get off, and we're going to catch the T train. I take 3 buses every day.
She could take a more direct route, but Ruby has to avoid some areas of the neighborhood.
That's the part of Mission that I can't go to because it's really dangerous for me. Because I can get in trouble because of the people that are there, because of my past life.
Ruby got involved in gang life in middle school.
You would see me wearing a lot of blue. You see somebody wearing red and you just, instead of even asking where you're from, you just go ahead and knock them out. That's the way they taught me, so that's what I would do.
In high school, Ruby and her sister started going to a neighborhood after school program where she got homework help and took life skills classes. That's also where she began meeting new people.
They started telling me that there was a program that they teach you how to sew, and I was like, I want to learn how to sew. I just want to do something new.
Ruby joined Turning Heads, a nonprofit that teaches sewing, fashion, and business skills to girls wrestling with poverty, family problems, gangs. She started coming to the group studio 2 days a week, and her priorities changed.
You start focusing on other things, like you start being like, oh, well, what if in the future I want to be a designer or something like that, and you start getting your head into something else.
Ruby joined Turning Heads at the perfect time, when it was branching out into a business. In 2005, a fan of the program commissioned the girls to make lavender-scented eye pillows. After designing a pattern and making a prototype, they realized they actually had a potential business on their hands. With adults as mentors, some of the girls started Sweet Dreams Cooperative. 19-year-old Nadia Johnson was a founding member.
We went to local vendors and asked them if they would carry our product, and they were like, yeah, this sounds really cool. And you know, they probably didn't think it would sell, but everyone bought like a few, and then they sold and they called back for more.
Sweet dreams.
Now the 8 girls sell their products at stores and yoga studios around San Francisco. Today they're filling orders for 62 satin eye pillows and gearing up for 2 holiday craft fairs.
We first cut it 9x5, and there's like different colors, like there's light purple, lavender purple. So then we take it over here to Nadia, and Nadia sews it like this. So then we put it on the ironing board,
and we make sure it's nice and crispy.
Well, right there in the jar that Sushi has, we have no lavender and we have flaxseed.
Like, lavender is the best scent to, like, just relaxation and then meditation.
The cooperative has been so successful, it's expanded its line of products to include sachets, yoga mat bags, and coin purses.
Hi, may I speak to Darcy? This is Nadia Johnson calling from Sweet Dreams. I wanted to let her know that her order of 12 eye pillows will be ready in 2 days.
Nadia is 19 and is the primary caregiver for her grandmother and younger sister. She likes being part of this growing business. She's even taken business classes at community college.
I really like doing something that I'm proud to be a part of, you know? I'm able to make decisions that affect a business, you know? I'm not just any old worker.
Cuatro, seis, I think I'm going to put 3 red, 1 hot pink, 3 purple, 1 black one, 2 green ones, and 2 gold ones.
Ruby is also proud of her newfound business skills, and she says she's learning to relate to people in less aggressive ways. Each of the girls in the Sweet Dream Co-op made about $1,000 in 2009. But Ruby stays involved for bigger reasons.
Just knowing that I can do something else instead of having my life be ruined, that really motivates me instead of just the money. And knowing that somebody else is doing it with me motivates me more.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in San Francisco.
You know those yellow wristbands that raise money for Lance Armstrong's cancer charity? The ones that say Live Strong on them? Well, they have yet another knockoff. This time it's from Lance Armstrong's buddy, comedian Ben Stiller. For the holidays, Stiller's working with Save the Children to raise money for a school in Haiti. Stiller sent a video message to Armstrong telling him all about what he calls his original fundraising idea. He's selling yellow headbands, think Zoolander style, emblazoned with the words Stiller Strong.
And I was thinking maybe, you know, I get some celebrities to wear them like you. Maybe you could wear one during your next bike race, or you could just put it on your quad, you know? So like when you're going up a mountain, you see it just like expanding. Stiller Strong, Stiller Strong. You know, whatever. Anyway, let me know what you think. Tweet at me, bro, okay?
Lance Armstrong, meanwhile, isn't taking this copyright infringement lying down. He's called an emergency board meeting and made a counter video, promising to sue Stiller no matter how badly those kids in Haiti need help. Of course, the boys are just having some good, clean fun for a worthy cause. So far, the Stiller Strong campaign has raised about $70,000 for the school. And that, believe it or not, is our globe at a glance.
By the way, they come in other colors, too. There's an orange one, so you could do sort of like a multi-colored sort of like rainbow thing, you know? If it's cold out too, it's like, oh, I'm raising money to help people and I'm staying warm. And I look cool. I can kind of not breathe.
Coming up, comic books and giant Christmas trees. You're listening to the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Lita Hartman in for Peggy Waymire. Mexico City got an early Christmas gift this year, the Guinness World Record for the tallest artificial Christmas tree. It stands in a traffic circle on the city's Grand Reforma Avenue. The tree is almost as tall as the skyscrapers that surround it. Grant Fuller watched the tree being built, and now he introduces us to the Brazilian workers who did the job.
With that countdown from the mayor, Mexico City just lit up the world's tallest Christmas tree. Fireworks explode above this towering cone of metal scaffolding. The tree is just over 362 feet tall and features 44 miles of Christmas lights that constantly change color. And just for good measure, it's also adorned with giant lights in the shape of snowflakes, music notes, and angels. As a sea of revelers looks up in awe, one small group of men stands out. That's because they're downright giddy. These 14 men came here from Brazil to build the tree. They work for an event production company that also holds the record for the world's tallest floating Christmas tree, built every year in a lagoon in Rio de Janeiro. A grinning Luis Bahia says building this tree was no big deal for them. This is just everyday work for me, he says. It's nothing new, but it's a little bit tough being so far from home. Working in Mexico does have its advantages. The workers say their salary tripled for this job, which took almost a month to complete. 2 days ago, the workers were busy adding the final touch to their creation. A monstrous crane hoists a huge steel star up to the top of the tree, giving it just enough extra height to break the record. From down below, you can barely spot a man's hard hat popping up through a hole in the treetop. After waving to his fellow workers on the ground, he reaches out to help guide the star into place. Later, at the tree lighting ceremony, this worker proudly introduced himself to me as
Ubiracil, montador da maior árvore do mundo.
Ubiracil, builder of the biggest tree in the world.
Eu, graças a Deus, coloquei a estrela no lugar.
Thanks be to God, I put the star in place on December 4th at 5 p.m. Seeing the Mexican people so happy makes me feel like we've achieved something.
While the Brazilian crew did lend their Christmas tree know-how to the project, they couldn't do it alone, of course. More than 100 Mexican workers joined them in the effort. They had to communicate with hand signals and a mix of Spanish and Portuguese the workers called portuñol. Mexican electrician José de la Rosa says it was an honor to work with his Brazilian friends.
They thought because of the simple fact that we're Mexicans, we would make them feel inferior just because they're Brazilian. But after working with us and forming this team with us, they'll go home happy. And that's a good thing.
Back at the celebration, a mariachi band performs in front of the tree. Despite his month of hard work at the top of the structure, Ubiracil is energized.
No,
I'm not tired. I'm happy and excited. With beauty like this, you don't have any reason to be tired.
Behind him, the tree is busy showing off another trick. It's pulsating purple, green, and blue. These guys know their tree is really just a big pile of metal. But one worker philosopher named Marcos Vinicius says that doesn't matter.
At Christmas, we all decorate trees. Some are made of metal, and some are actually real. But we all believe in Christmas.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller at the world's tallest Christmas tree, Mexico City.
When you think of likely topics for a comic book, the Ugandan Civil War isn't the first thing that comes to mind, but that's exactly what the DC comic book series Unknown Soldier is about. Even more surprising, the series is based on serious research and written by a history buff. Unknown Soldier centers around Dr. Luanga Moses, a fictional character who left Uganda when he was just 7 years old. After more than 20 years in the U.S., he returns to Uganda with his wife. Both of them are physicians and pacifists who want to offer their services to Ugandans who've been suffering through a civil war. Luanga Moses is shocked by the violence he encounters, but after he sees child soldiers in the Lord's Resistance Army committing unspeakable acts of brutality, he decides to avenge the killings. And he does so by using the violence he once rejected. Author Joshua Dysart wrote the Unknown Soldier series. He spoke to host Peggy Waymire.
Joshua Dysart, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, absolutely.
I want to start by asking you how you even got the idea to write a comic series about Uganda.
It was a combination of market demands on me and my personal interests. So DC approached me to revamp an old World War II adventure character they had called the Unknown Soldier, and I had to come up with sort of a revisionist pitch, and I was very interested in the Lord's Resistance Army and Joseph Kony and had been since 2001, so that was naturally where I went. There wasn't a lot of time to generate the pitch, so I just sort of went to my default, you know?
And DC meaning DC Comics,
that's
the company.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Tell us a little, for those who don't know, about Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army and why that interested you.
Why it interested me is after 2001, after 9/11, I became very much engaged in studying religious extremists. And I came across Kony at that time, and I just couldn't shake him, you know, and I'd been reading about him ever since. Kony himself is a rebel who has been operative since he was 26 years old. He came onto the stage in around 1987 and started an organization that would eventually become known as the Lord's Resistance Army. And they're sort of a religious, mystic, military movement who's responsible for profound atrocities in East Africa, predominantly in Acholi Land, Uganda, up until recently.
So how did you go about doing, I mean, how does one do research for a comic book about this kind of brutal violence and warfare?
It was very difficult. But really, you know, I very quickly realized the only way to do this right and to be responsible about this material was to go there. So in 2007, roughly 6 months after the ceasefire, which, by the way, is now null and void, I went ahead and traveled to Acholi Land, Uganda, and spent a little over a month there on the Sudan border and proceeded to do my research. And I just talked to everyone. I talked to everyone, yeah.
How hard was it to get access to the people who had been victims of the violence there?
Shockingly easy, embarrassingly easy. Part of my immense white guilt, I should say that I'm a white male from Texas. Part of my immense white guilt about this was the access I got once I was there. Recently, there'd been reportage, but over the 2-decades-long conflict, let's remind people, one of the longest-running humanitarian crises of our generation, definitely, over the 2-decades-long crisis, there had been little relative reportage on this conflict in the Western media. So, I mean, it was unbelievable. It was embarrassing where I was allowed to go.
So do you think the access had to do with the fact that you were a white Western man who had come and was interested in their story and they just needed to talk and maybe hoped their story would get out? Or why else would they give you such access?
Yeah, completely. That's completely it. You know, it's part of this massive ethnic-wide therapy that they're going through. You know, I've heard reports as high as 60 to 70% of the population suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So absolutely.
So they want to talk.
They want to talk.
And I bet they talked and talked.
Absolutely. Wow. And, you know, I mean, I talk to everybody. I talk to child soldiers who are still involved in the conflict. I talk to people from the Ugandan People's Defense Force, which is the opposite side of the conflict, religious leaders, political leaders, you know, everyone.
And before, Josh, that I ask you to tell us some of those stories, I want to go back to what you said about this white guilt you had over the access. What's that about?
What is that about? You know, I don't know that I can go any deeper into that. I don't know if this is that kind of show. I don't really know. There was always some fear approaching this subject matter. And at first, when I first pitched it and it got greenlit, I was a wave of terror sort of flooded over me. And I thought, well, here I go. I'm going to spend the next few years of my life, completely capitalizing on these people's suffering.
So that's why you felt guilty. It felt exploitive to you?
Completely. And it still does, you know. I mean, I have two modes when I'm writing on this book. One is I feel like I'm doing the right thing and I'm reaching out to a readership that would never, ever engage with this material by couching it in these kind of action tropes. And the other side of me that comes out alone in the dark, you know, when I'm writing at night, is that I'm totally exploiting this situation and people who live through really atrocious things.
Well, that's pretty understandable. It is hard to think of the Ugandan conflict with the Lord's Resistance Army in terms of a comic book. And of course, I looked at the comic book. I read a lot of it, and it's pretty gruesome. And it's odd to see it in a comic book form.
Right. Well, let me defend my medium briefly. It is a medium, and so like anything, film and novels and anything else, we're just a way of transmitting information. So we can tackle any subject to any degree. It's true that there are market demands on us to sort of dumb it down, but there are some phenomenal people. There's a gentleman by the name of Joe Sacco who does graphic novels that are real reportage, not what I've done, but genuine nonfiction graphic novels about war zones. He spent time in Chechnya and et cetera. So the medium can do anything. My situation is that I am involved in a corporate comic book being published by a company predominantly known for superheroes. So I have to walk a fine line.
I see. Okay, Josh, I want to go back to your research when you actually went to Uganda and had access to all of these places where victims and people suffering through post-traumatic stress told you their terrible stories. Can you share with us a few of the stories that were the most poignant to you?
You know, this is always an interesting question. There's so much that gets left out of the comic book because of the horror and stuff of that. And I'm also reticent to overly, you know, to talk about this stuff too much. There's the horror stories and then there's the really amazing stories. I met several children, very young children, who escaped the Lord's Resistance Army, which is an incredible feat, not just physically getting away from the group, but emotionally. You have to understand, most of these children who are indoctrinated were forced to do something really heinous at the very beginning of their indoctrination process. The most common is to kill your own parents or another family member. And this totally turns upside down their moral understanding of the universe. And really, and you do that to a child at around 9, and the odds of them sort of coming back from that are pretty rough. So it takes amazing personal psychological courage to walk away from that. I spoke to parents who, women, who were stolen and from their families, given to LRA soldiers as wives, and then had children, and then escaped with their children. These are the stories that are the most emotionally engaging. But I also had, you know, a child tell me that he and several other children are forced to bite to death another human being. And those are the things that I don't put in the comic book. Oh.
How did you get through that psychologically? I mean, you probably never intended to hear, well, maybe you did, those kinds of stories. But I'm wondering how it affected you.
Well, you know, I had an intellectual understanding of what I was going to hear when I got there, but that doesn't prepare you for what happens emotionally. So I actually think while I was there, you know, it was so funny. I was emotionally exhausted the whole time I was there, but I never really dealt with it. And it wasn't until I got back to the States that I had a real profound emotional crisis almost about the whole thing, especially because...
What happened?
Well, you know, nothing really happened. I just sunk into a deep pondering about existence and humanity's
and
ability
life
to
life and evil.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, and then I had to, on top of all that, while wrestling with this, I had to sit down and write this kind of action commercial war book, you know, about these
stories. Yeah, how
stories.
Did you do that? I mean, your protagonist has terrible nightmares. I'm wondering, did he represent you at all? Did you have terrible nightmares? Did it touch any of a side of you that you didn't want to see?
You know, it's so interesting. I think that I suppressed a lot of what I heard, and I tried not to visualize a lot of what I heard. And I think to this day, I still do that, which is why I'm so reticent to talk about some of the stories that I heard. My protagonist is absolutely the closest thing to a representation of myself as I could get into this kind of story. I mean, I have exaggerated, obviously, his behavior patterns and his nightmares and things like that. But absolutely. I mean, it was a really difficult patch of the world to walk through, you know, for me. I mean, for a middle class Westerner.
Tell us a little bit about your main character, this doctor and his wife, who take us through the comic book.
Moses Luwanga was born in Uganda. His family fled the end of the Idi Amin period before the Ugandan-Tanzanian War. And so Moses was raised in the United States, went to Harvard Medical, and decided that he would go back to Uganda and sort of save his people, which is really a comment on my part on this sort of hubris that Western culture has about Africa, this notion that I'm Western educated. And when he gets there, you know, he meets a beautiful Ugandan woman who is educated at McGrary University, one of the great African universities. And he's sort of is humbled by her abilities as a doctor and as a human being and as a Christian. He's a non-believer. And I should say, religion is a huge part of Ugandan culture. And so the book starts with him receiving an award for pacifism for his actions in Uganda. He's been there for 2 years. And when our first chapter ends, he's killed a child. And then he slowly sort of descends into this arc of accepting violence over peace.
What happened to Moses Luwanga? He started as a pacifist and became so violent. And his dreams in the comic book are incredibly violent.
Yeah, yeah. You know, this is the part where it gets really tricky. And if I can be totally honest, this is the part where I feel like maybe I failed as a writer. In my original pitch, when I was frightened about doing this project and I was sort of really, really pulping it up, you know, for lack of a better term, I put in this whole thing about CIA programming and all this jazz, and it got greenlit, and I went there, and I suddenly thought, what a much more interesting and difficult story to tell is the true story of how a pacifist would choose a path of violence. But unfortunately, they really liked my original pitch. So there are these elements, these sort of pulpy elements that drive him in that direction. But I like to still feel like it's a psychological decision he makes, that he is so overcome and overwhelmed by the horror he sees and so unimpressed with the way that the Ugandan government under President Museveni has handled the situation, that he just snaps and he makes the Colonel Kurtz decision, you know, the decision that only war ends war.
I should say there is some sort of resolution at the end. This doctor hero, Moses, does manage to save some children, for example, but he doesn't really manage to banish his inner demon alter ego. Where are you intending to take your hero?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd like to use the word hero very loosely because he does some really horrible things throughout this series. And things that are indefensible and things that I would not personally make the choice to do. I really want to walk a very fine line. I want to ask this question honestly as the material can support, about the role of violence in our world and systemic violence and also violence that comes out of us naturally. And so I don't really want to answer that question. I'd rather just ask it repeatedly because I don't think that I know the answer. I don't really know. When Gandhi said, you know, we should lay down to the Nazi and give him your homes and lay down your lives and step aside, as someone who once identified himself as a pacifist, I just don't agree with that philosophy. On the other hand, a philosophy of absolute aggression obviously doesn't work. So I want my character to constantly be both rewarded and punished for the actions that he takes. And hopefully there's some truth in the middle ground. I don't know. We'll see.
Joshua Dysart is the author of the comic book series, The Unknown Soldier. Joshua, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Joshua Dysart is the author of the comic book series, Unknown Soldier. You can see a page of the comic at our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Coming up, a massive building in Liberia's capital is home to hundreds of former soldiers. We'll spend a day in the place that locals call the Titanic. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Lita Hartman, in for Peggy Wehmeyer. Author William Power spent 2 years in Liberia during that country's civil war. He directed relief programs for an aid group operating there. Powers returned to Liberia for a few months after the war. He was looking forward to catching up with old friends. In this aid worker diary, he tells us about finding some unexpected Christmas cheer.
Despite the holiday season, I just put in a 14-hour workday and felt exhausted. But when my cell phone rang, I knew the day was not over. "I have malaria," said a friend, a 23-year-old Liberian student named Maitu. I drove across the city to the clinic where Maitu was connected to an IV drip. Then I drove her and her sister back to their apartment, stopping to buy them a bag of groceries since they didn't have any food in their house. For an hour, I sat with them in their mildew-coated home in darkness. Like about 99% of Liberians, they don't have electricity. That night, I slept poorly. Perhaps the hardest part of aid work is the daily dose of global inequality that you have to swallow. It's impossible to fathom that some people hoard billions while others die of preventable diseases like malaria. I also felt guilty. Each morning, I take an expensive anti-malarial pill. But Liberians can't afford the shocking $250 a month price tag for the drug. After all, that's about 5 times a typical monthly wage here. I was still awash in negativity the next day when I visited Maitu. I vented aloud about all of this, but her response threw me. She smiled through cheeks still hot with malaria and said, "Where there's life, there's hope." It's not Pollyannish. Ain't no New Age mantras in a country where everyone I've ever met lost at least one person in a war. She simply meant that her illness, grave as it may be, is tiny in the big scheme of things. She was still alive, after all, even if that life wasn't always easy or smooth. Some music floated up through her apartment's only window. Paul Simon's African-influenced tune, Graceland. And man, do Liberians love Paul Simon. My Two Sister leapt up and danced. As Simon crooned Poor Boys and Pilgrims with Families and We Are Going to Graceland, I noticed My Two, in her sickbed, moving her head to the rhythm. Despite my years working in Liberia, I was struck by her attitude. Wasn't it impossible to be grateful under such deplorable circumstances? It took me a while to finally understand the mystery. I realized that My Two was choosing a positive response to the situation. So instead of seething, bitter, and resentful, she genuinely felt grateful to be alive. A week later, My Two had recovered. "How da body?" I asked her in Liberian English. "Body fine," she answered. She didn't have much money this typically balmy holiday season, not even enough to own a radio, but she wasn't complaining. She bought herself a new shirt for $4 and shorts for $2. I asked her what she'd do for Christmas. "I'll put on my Christmas clothes," she said, "and I'll dance." Her smile was radiant. It lit up the room, and I heard echoes of Graceland.
William Powers is the author of the Liberia memoir, Blue Clay People, Seasons on Africa's Fragile Edge.
I'm going to Graceland, Memphis, Tennessee. I'm going to Graceland. Poor boys and pilgrims with families, and we are going to Graceland. And my traveling companions are ghosts in empty sockets. I'm looking at ghosts and empties. But I've reason to believe we all will be received in Graceland.
During his time in Monrovia, William Powers probably saw the huge hulking building that sits on the main road into the city. Liberians have nicknamed it the Titanic. It houses hundreds of former soldiers who fought in Liberia's civil war, which ended in 2003. Reporter Grant Fuller recently spent 24 hours as a Titanic squatter, sleeping in the building, eating with the residents, and playing with their kids. Here's Grant's story of a day in the life of the Titanic.
Emmanuel Flomo rolls out of bed and steps outside onto a spacious, private third-floor balcony with a sweeping ocean view. It sounds nice, but this is no luxury resort. Flomo's a squatter, and this abandoned building, nicknamed the Titanic for its imposing size, circular windows, and ocean liner shape, has been his home for the past 5 years.
It was just a vacant place. We decided to come and live here. We just live in peace.
Flomo perches himself on the concrete balcony ledge to brush his teeth in darkness. There's no running water or electricity here. But Flomo is one of the lucky ones. He's getting ready for work this morning. He scrapes by on $3 a day, doing construction labor on what, ironically, will be a luxury beachfront hotel.
I'm a 27 years of age man, and now I have not yet completed my high school because of the rate of poverty. Because my mother don't have money to send me to school, my father don't have money to send me to school. Presently now, no job in the country.
Like many residents here, Flomo fought with former President Charles Taylor's forces during the Liberian Civil War. It was the same war that forced a halt to construction of the Titanic, which was intended to become the new Ministry of Health. So when Taylor was ousted in 2003, the ex-fighters lost everything and moved in here out of desperation. Now, Flomo considers himself a victim of a senseless war.
But people grabbed me and put me into the war. I got used to the war. I fought the war. And then now I'm coming up to know how very much destructive war is. Because the same war is what got me to be sitting down here by now living in a government building.
He packs his bag with a change of clothes and heads out a rickety door as the building comes to life. Outside the front entrance, a young man and his buddies fiddle with a problematic tape deck in the tiny car he sometimes drives as a taxi. On the second floor terrace, a war widow serves pepper soup out of a huge pot. Rebels burned her house years ago, but today she's moved on, selling to men who are themselves ex-fighters. In the small open courtyard, a woman and her 10-year-old daughter are busy scrubbing their family's clothing against a washboard.
I love cleanness. Cleanness next to holiness.
With 8 children and an unemployed husband, the washboard is the only thing certain about this Mother's Day. Despite the hardship, the Titanic is an impressively organized community. Each of the 4 floors has its own leader who can approve or reject new residents. Augustus Tapa is chairman of the entire building. He was chosen because he was never a soldier, so the residents believe he's better suited to settling disputes.
You see, what we do normally is the environment, we talk to them.
You see, what we normally do is talk to people about keeping the building clean. And we make sure that if there's any conflict, we calm it down right here. I call all the floor leaders and I bring them together so we can solve the problem.
Tapa stations himself by a tiny closet in the lobby which holds shelves of medicine, his own makeshift pharmacy for the building.
I have some painkillers. I have medication for worms. I have some vitamins.
To say that business is slow would be an understatement. But thankfully, the pharmacy is not Chairman Tapa's only business. Standing in the closet space, he flips through a flimsy school notebook and explains the names and numbers he's scrawled into it.
So I got $100. He carried 3,000 LD.
This is his daily SUSU register. In Liberia, the daily SUSU is a small deposit you make into a savings account held by someone you trust. Many Liberians tend to keep their money under the mattress, but if you lack the discipline to save, the daily SUSU is for you. At the end of the month, Tapa keeps one day's deposit for himself as payment for keeping the money safe.
I call it a petty business, this little place that I'm hanging on by.
The name of Tapa's bank/pharmacy/chairman's office is painted on the concrete wall near the door. Better days, the sign says.
I gave it this name because there are better days ahead, and in the future I will make it bigger than this.
For others in the Titanic, the day rolls on with nothing to do. The concept of lunchtime is pretty much irrelevant here. Most people can only afford one simple evening meal of rice and soup. But the Titanic's early afternoon hours are filled with the sounds of children. With parents unable to pay their school fees, the kids of the Titanic are at home, running amok in their giant concrete playground. In an empty room at the end of the long third floor hallway, some kids discover the fun of aluminum cans someone left behind. Near the stairwell, a little boy belts out his favorite song. Outside, 4 friends take turns sitting on squashed plastic jerry cans and pulling each other across the dirt by a rope. And on the top floor, a brother and sister chase around a small puppy dog.
Oh my kids, yeah. I got Matthew Martin. I got Manate Martin Martin.
Cooper Martin has 7 children.
I got Guandao Martin. I got Connor Martin.
He sometimes teaches them in the top floor hallway. For lack of a better option, he's painted a solid black rectangle on the wall to serve as a blackboard. Martin says he was forced to join Charles Taylor's personal army and then was left with nothing when it was all over. He and many others still face discrimination because of the war.
So for us to get a job is hard.
For us to get a job, it's hard. Nobody will employ us. They say, those are Charles Taylor's people there. Myself, I went to school, but I stopped in the 7th grade. So the little I have learned, that's what I'm teaching my children.
On the floor below, a circle of friends pass the time by playing a board game Liberians call Ludo.
Just to keep relax ourselves, when there's nothing to do, just play, just to keep the day going.
Around 5 o'clock, a steady stream of people comes flowing back into the Titanic. Whether they spent the day breaking rocks, hauling sand, washing clothes, driving a taxi, or selling water, the Titanic's residents come home spent. After a long day at the construction site, Emmanuel Flomo grabs a towel and heads straight out towards the main road, bucket of water in hand.
I'm going to sit down in the darkness to the dark part of the area. That is a shower. It's not a bathroom. It's not any other area suitable for taking bath.
Meanwhile, it's dinner time inside the Titanic. For some, that means a heaping plate of rice with an oily cassava leaf sauce. But others will eat only plain rice tonight, or nibble on a piece of chicken or a handful of peanuts. Soon after dark, residents congregate in and around the only room in the building with generator power. Welcome to the Titanic's Video Club. 20 cents buys admission to three films shown on a small TV in a huge ground floor room with straw mats covering the windows. The movie tonight is an old Chinese melodrama that has the whole audience gripped. The Little by Little Video Club, as it's called, was started by 24-year-old Darius Yunick.
Only me can make the place to be lively because everyone all like, yeah,
I'm the one who keeps the building lively at night, Darius says. We have a big population here and no electricity, so people can be scared of us and say that we're bad people. I decided to make a video club here so everyone can come around and be together. Others skip the movie and use the time to get some much-needed sleep. Earlier today, Joseph Seo was paid to haul buckets of beach sand to be used for mixing cement. The hard labor has caught up to him.
Well, I'm resting now until tomorrow. Yeah, I'm tired now. Okay, but tomorrow before I will get back on my feet to hustle.
The day is also done for Emmanuel Flomo, the construction worker. Back in his Ocean View room after his outdoor bucket bath, he ducks under the mosquito net, lies down on a bed of wooden crates with a thin mattress, and begins to pray.
Dear Father, we are about to sleep in there, Father. We ask that, dear Lord, may you protect us and guard us from every other evil.
As he does so, he's ever mindful of how far he's come since his days of fighting in the war.
I'm very much grateful to God that now there is no war in Liberia, that at least we are in peace. I tell you, thank you, worship you, the Father, forgive our sin. In Jesus' mighty name, we pray.
As the video club downstairs finally winds down and the clock nears midnight, the sound of the sea takes over again. And hundreds of Titanic squatters sleep another night in this hulking home that's not their own. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Monrovia, Liberia.
Just 1 month after Grant Fuller embedded himself in the Titanic, all of the squatters were evicted by the Liberian government. The Ministry of Health says it's ready to complete construction and move into the building. Each Titanic family was given at least $200 in compensation, and Grant tells us they left willingly. Today, the outside walls of the building have been painted white, and the Titanic once again stands empty. But we've got lots of photos of the Titanic when it was still operating as a small city. You can go to our website to see them, worldvisionreport.org. There are some stories that change a reporter's life. In this reporter's notebook, Michelle Betts tells us about one piece that not only changed her life, but left her with a daughter.
They arrive about once a week, text messages or emails from my daughter, Lucy. The messages are always upbeat. She asks how I am and then asks about Daddy and Ziggy, our dog, even though she's never met either, just seen plenty of pictures. In the latest message, she tells me there won't be a party for her high school graduation. That's because the school has no money. A sign of the times, perhaps. And when I ask her about boys, she assures me she doesn't have a boyfriend. Yet. A typical teenager, you say, but really, Lucy is anything but. Lucy's an orphan, one of the thousands that were left without parents or any kind of family support in the wake of the 1994 Rwandan genocide. I first met Lucy almost 3 years ago. She was one of the young people I spoke to for a story I did for this program. I was profiling traumatized youth in Rwanda. Lucy recounted witnessing the murder of her mother and narrowly escaping death herself. She'd been hospitalized for post-traumatic stress several times and was utterly hopeless. Here's what she said then.
There is no future. For me, personally, I believe that even God doesn't love me. Perhaps God has abandoned us because even the survivors of our families don't help us. We're alone, and we will remain alone. We're orphans.
The story was one of the most difficult I'd ever done. It haunted me, especially Lucy's story. So I kept in touch with her, checking in on the now 20-year-old during the work visits I frequently made to Rwanda. We developed a bond, and I broke my profession's ethical rule that says a reporter shouldn't get too close to her sources. Lucy is too old to adopt formally, but I support her financially and, I hope, emotionally. In essence, Lucy has become my daughter. Here's what she says about our relationship.
Michelle, my mommy, gave me the advice every day to be strong, not to be sad, because she loves me so much. And I try to appreciate that advice.
Sure, we sometimes argue. I was against the cell phone she bought with the money I gave her. But at least now I have a way of calling her and hearing her voice. I've watched how this traumatized young woman has developed enough confidence to plan for her future. She wants to be an accountant, and even talks about eventually earning a master's degree. And she wants to give back to other orphans.
I will help those children to give the affection as if her mother, and I tried to give the advice for his life.
As for that rule about not getting too close to a source, well, for me, it was oh so worth it to get close to Lucy and to see how some love and support was able to change a life once devoid of both. And the God she once said abandoned her, today she sings to him.
I sing because he make me happy in my heart. Tu es là au camp de nos vies, et c'est toi qui nous fait vivre. Tu es là au camp de nos vies, bien vivant au Jésus-Christ.
Michelle Betts is a freelance reporter based in Cairo. That's it for this week. Remember to check out our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can also download a podcast and read blogs from our reporters around the world. Peggy Wehmeyer will be back next week. I'm Lita Hartman.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.